Good evening, and welcome to Bevis Mark Synagogue. It is a pleasure to have everyone here with us this evening for the beginning of our new series this year. I'd like to thank Carol and Stuart Morgenstein for sponsoring tonight's refreshments. The topic of this year's series is the Wise Son, the daughters of the London S&P Sorority community. Really, the very first comment someone said to me tonight was, why is it called the Wise Son? That's a bit of a paradox. It actually was Stuart that asked me, which is unfortunate that he's just left the room. And so perhaps I will speak slowly so that by the time he returns, I will be up to the answer. But the title actually relates to a conversation that I had with some people last year concerning the topic that we did towards at the end of kind of the season, post-Passover series, where we looked at the famous and infamous of Anglo-Jewry and who came out of Bevis Marks. And we looked at Daniel Mendoza, the pugilist, Sir Moses Montefiore, the great philanthropist, and Benjamin Disraeli, the convert, who became, of course, prime minister. And it was in that context of preparing that somebody had recommended to me or kind of wondered why there weren't any ladies in the series, and suggested that perhaps I should include some ladies in that series. And I began to reflect on that and try to think about some important ladies from the history of Anglo-Jewry. And I kind of debated back and forth. And what I ultimately kind of concluded is that in terms of international figures, there weren't. There weren't any, and that it actually would be somewhat actually, by trying to create a space for them in that group of those men would actually be kind of, just silly on some level and actually not, recognize the contributions that ladies make, but not in a sense to pretend the contributions were maybe different than they actually were. But in exploring that kind of possibility or searching around, I ended up coming across a whole group of ladies in the Sephardi community in Bevis Marks that I felt were really worthy of attention, that most of whom I hadn't been familiar with before, but the more that I kind of read about them and kind of all of a sudden realized that there was a whole group of them, it made their collective significance all the more greater. Because what I found was that they actually represented a movement among the ladies of the community that I think actually speaks to a movement that was taking place, and I think that's significant. And so in that original series, partly just for fun, I identified each of those three men with different sons from the four sons of the Haggadah, and looked at Mendoza as the Tam, because of course Jacob, who wrestled, is known as the Tam in the Bible, and looked at Montefiore as the one who does not know how to ask, because I felt that he was just, he wasn't a scholar, but he was just, he got on with things. He didn't ask, he just did. And then of course Disraeli, for a variety of reasons, kind of, pointed him with the Rasha, and I did point out, that the Rasha at least is at the table, and Disraeli has a complicated story with his Jewish identity, which seemed to kind of fit with the way the Rasha and Haggadah portrayed as a complicated figure, and that left me with saying, how interesting is it that I can't actually identify a chacham? I can't identify a wise son, someone who grew up in the community and becomes, a great scholar, particularly outside of the, at least outside of the rabbinate, at the very least. And that was surprising to me. And yet what I discovered is that there were people that were publishing and were writing and were making intellectual and literary contributions, but they weren't men. They were ladies. And that really prompted me to this topic and to say that the wise son of Bevis Marx is actually these ladies. They are the wise son of the S&P Sephardic community. And I found their collective narrative to be particularly moving important and frankly inspiring. And in terms of kind of the values of our community and the kind of values that I want to promote in terms of scholarship, certainly among ladies, is I think we have a beautiful example, you know, of that in the 19th century, when at a time when we don't think of that, and we don't kind of think of those figures, perhaps even the more so in light of the fact that there weren't many men that were doing it. And that makes it even all the more intriguing, because it wasn't like there was just this whole kind of society of Jews that were engaging in this kind of activity. And maybe in fact, because of that, they found their space. It kind of became their thing that they did. And I think that's something really profound and important, and something that you don't find in other Jewish communities. In the 19th century, you look at German Jewry with all the, you know, kind of movements happening there. It's not really the ladies. Maybe they're running salons and so on, but they're not themselves making literary contributions in the same way. And so it really spoke to me that this was a topic that would be exciting to research and exciting to share, you know, with the broader community. So with that, way of introduction. I'm really pleased that you're all able to be here this evening, and I'm excited to take this journey with you as I learn about these figures and this this moment in Anglo-Jewish history, and have the opportunity to share it with you. So let us begin, because while. What I'll say just is, while I'm focusing on the Sephardi community, the Spanish and Portuguese community, that isn't to say that there were no men doing anything like this. There were some. And it's not to say that there were no Ashkenazim that were doing things like this, because there were some. But what struck me was the kind of the numbers of ladies, Sephardic ladies that were doing it, that felt to me to be representative of something more, even though you can find examples of men or Ashkenazim that were doing this as well. So they weren't alone in doing it, but I think kind of the energy that was behind this does seem to me, at least, to be somewhat distinct. And so what I'd like to do tonight, the large part, is to provide the Anglo context for what takes place, as well as the Jewish context for what happens. And so we'll be kind of taking a big picture view of the 19th century in England and among Anglo Jewry, what's happening in the community, the challenges that they're facing, and so on. And then in the last part, we will look at tonight's wise son, Abigail Lindo, and we'll talk about her and what her contributions were, and a bit about kind of how she fits into this broader narrative. So let us begin this journey together. So let's start by talking about the 19th century, particularly the early 19th century, the first half of the 19th century, which is where we'll really be focusing a lot of our energies. What's interesting about Anglo-Jewry in the early 19th century is that perhaps up until, you know, post-World War II, Anglo-Jewry, it's probably the only time in the history of Anglo-Jewry that the majority of Jews in this country are native-born, okay? So in a lot of ways, Anglo-Jewry in the early 1800s looks like Anglo-Jewry in the early, 2000s. In that most of the people there are native-born. There obviously had been immigration that had taken place in the 1600s when the community was founded. Additional immigration of Ashkenazi Jews in the middle of that 1700s. But by the time you get to the early 1800s, most of the Jews that are here had been born here. Right? It's a native community. It's a community that's, in that sense, comfortable, acculturated, know the language, speak the language as their primary language. Their mother tongue is no longer Portuguese or Yiddish or Dutch, but their native tongue is English. And that probably won't be the case again until, maybe the last 50 years in England, because of course, during the 1800s, you'll start having increased immigration from Central Europe to England. And then in the late 1800s, you'll have mass immigration from Eastern Europe, right? And so it's not really going to be until later that you'll have once again a Jewish population here that actually were all born here, to a large extent. What's interesting to me is that many of the trends that you find here are the same thing within the American Jewish community as well. And so they will experience, they'll be very similar. The community in America will be smaller than Anglo-Jewry until the late 1800s when 150,000 Eastern European Jews moved to England, 1.5 million of them will move to New York, right? And so that will all of a sudden, change the balance in terms of population numbers. But really during this time, England is the largest English-speaking Jewish community in the world, but the American community in many ways reflects the same trends that you find in England at that time as well. And so you'll also have that significance where the early 1800s will also be kind of a native American Jewish community as well in the way that it is in this country. The community though isn't massive in the early 1800s. You're talking about 10,000, 15,000. It's not a huge community. I don't have the precise numbers, but it's not a massive community. I mean, America in 1825 has about 2,000 Jews, okay, that are living in all of the United States. In England, you have more than that, but it's not some massive community. In fact, at the turn, in the 19th century, you'll have Bevis Marks. You have the Great Synagogue, Duke's Place Synagogue. The Ashkenazi Shul, you'll have a synagogue that had broken away from there called the Hambro or the Hamburg Synagogue, and that's basically it. I mean, that's a Jewish community at that time. And then during the 1800s, obviously, there'll start being additional communities in other neighborhoods, and then obviously, as you start getting larger and larger numbers of immigrants here, you'll have more and more synagogues that will open up over time. But it's not a massive community. But it's a very comfortable, I would say, community at that time. And as they move into the early 1800s, they will start facing a variety of challenges, some of which perhaps, like I said, by thinking about their generation and the way that we think of kind of our generation or, the past generation, are somewhat similar in some of the different kinds of challenges that they face. Perhaps not exactly the first one, but in certain regards, yes. So one of the major challenges that the community begins to face is a general malaise. There seems to be a lack of kind of energy that is pouring into these communities. And as a result, you have a bit of a drift that will begin to take place. Perhaps not surprising, as people are just kind of comfortable in the society in which they live, that begins to, people feel comfortable at home in that and perhaps don't hang on as tightly to the Jewish community that perhaps an immigrant would, that kind of that's a place where they can feel, at ease. And so you will start to see that play out in different ways, and we'll look at that in a moment. But in addition to that, you also have, among certain groups, a concerted effort to convert Jews. That's something we think of kind of in medieval times, or perhaps what we might call the early modern times, in the 1600s and so on. But you do find it again in the early 1800s as well, that there will be groups that are interested in converting Jews to societies that are established. One is called the London Society for the Promotion of Christianity Among Jews. Just say it explicitly. That's founded in 1807, okay? And then you'll have another group called the Philo-Judeans, which is founded in 1820, okay? They have slightly different tactics, but the general approach of them is what is called Philo-Semitism, where they will love and embrace Jews, not try to kind of hound us and oppress us in order to get us to convert, but through kind of embracing us and actually encouraging greater rights and privileges for Jews out of the hope that by kind of being increasingly welcoming to Jewish people, that that will actually inspire them, inspire Jewish people to embrace Christianity. Because they'll say, wow, look at these kind Christians, you know, it's time for us to join them. Kind of take this approach. Of course, Jews hadn't converted previously because Christians were mean to them. But if Christians are nice to them, then they will want to convert. Apparently there was a joke that went around that said, you know, what's the difference between, you know, a Philo-Semite and an anti-Semite? And they said, well, a Philo-Semite is an anti-Semite that loves Jews. And so, you know, to some extent, that was a true commentary on what in fact had happened, right? So in terms of the challenge, right, that's going to be an important challenge, you know, during that time. Okay, so one is going to be conversion. Now, of course, the most famous conversion of Anglo-Jewry at that time takes place in what year, Zev? 1816. In 1816, you will have Isaac Disraeli convert his children to the Church of England, notably his son Benjamin, who was born in the year 1804, at the age of 12, just before his bar mitzvah, will be converted to the Church of England. Of course, paving the way for him to ultimately enter politics and become prime minister, but nonetheless. And his story, yes?
I don't think there's any evidence that baby's moms held bar mitzvah then.
Maybe not in the way that we think of, but yeah, halachically, you become a bar mitzvah, right? Yeah. Now, in terms of that story reflects a couple things. One is obviously conversion, and the other is, well, it really happens as part of a drift, right? Meaning, it does not seem that the Disraeli family was particularly engaged. They were already living in West London and probably only kind of participated in synagogue life in an infrequent type of way already, right? And so kind of the combination of those things leads in part, including altercation at the synagogue, right, leads to that movement. And so we'll have conversion as a challenge, right? And we'll have what we might call maybe assimilation, right, or acculturation, right, depending on how you think about it. And the third challenge that the community will face, though this is an interesting one, right, is obviously the beginning of reform within London as well. In 1840, you will have the creation of the first reform congregation in London. It will be founded by members of the Sephardi community and the Ashkenazi community together. They will call their synagogue, right, the British Jewish congregation at first, right, West London, and it will be this idea that they're creating a new synagogue, which is not Ashkenazi or Sephardic, it is simply for Anglo-Jews, though of course much of their liturgy will actually be dominated by Sephardic, so in a lot of ways it actually is a kind of a Spanish and Portuguese Reform congregation, even though when people think of Reform, they usually think of Ashkenaz. It actually seems to be kind of strongly led by Sephardim, particularly the Makata family is very active in that, as well as the brother of Sir Moses Montefiore is one of the early members there, as well as the Goldsmith family, a prominent Ashkenazi family that were also relatives, they're all related to each other, that break away and start this new synagogue in West London. They've been agitating for some time that the Spanish and Portuguese community should set up an additional synagogue in West London, to which the leadership refused to do. And after about 15 years of trying to convince them, they finally break away and start their own. And then a couple years later, they finally then set up a synagogue in West London. And so too little, too late, when they actually agreed to do it, that community said they were no longer interested in kind of, you know, coming back into the umbrella. So there you have it. But of course, part of the one of the reasons for reform, right, wasn't simply, and in fact, in a lot of ways, wasn't particularly ideological in England the way that it was in Germany, but it was practical. They lived in West. They felt that the kind of the way the services were being held at the synagogue were not capturing the attention of the youth. They were afraid about things like conversion and assimilation, and they said, we will reform aspects of, you know, synagogue life, of Jewish life, in order to preserve Judaism, right? And not the way, right, and not as a way to erode Judaism, but actually to preserve it. So depending on how you look at that, reform is coming to respond to those things, but from the purpose of Bevis Marx, that now reform is another one of these challenges to add to this list, to add to this list as well, right? And so there are a variety of things that are taking place, right, all in the you know, early in the 1800s, okay? Okay. Okay, so let's see, we can kind of put some years and just kind of keep track, right? So you have 1807 and the 1820, right? You can think already of the, right, the assimilation, right? You think of the Disraelis, right, in 16? Right, and reform 1840, right, that takes place, right? So you can see, right, all of these things are happening around that time, okay? Now, there's one additional challenge that the community is facing, and that is the question of emancipation. Now, since Jews began returning to England in the middle of the 17th century, relative to, you know, their co-religionists in continental Europe, they were doing fairly well, right? There was no kind of persecution in the way that it was in other places. They were able to, you know, to live and to, you know, make a living. But there were limitations. There were what were called disabilities placed on the community. They couldn't engage, for example, in trade within the city of London originally. And there were other kind of limitations. Certainly they couldn't hold office. They weren't Christians, right? And so there was kind of this, at this point, so it's kind of recognition. You can live here, but it's a Christian country. Obviously, you're not going to take place, part of it completely. So when we talk about emancipation, right, it depends what you mean by emancipation, right? Emancipation could be freedom to live someplace. It could be the fact that you have the rights of citizens. It could be you have the right to vote. And probably kind of the final thing is always the right to take office, right? And to take office as a Jew, right? To take an oath of office. It doesn't require you to take an oath to, right, the New Testament, as it were, right, to the Christian Bible. And so this will be a question that will be an open question for nearly two centuries. In 1753, there will be something called the Jew Bill, which will actually attempt to give foreign-born Jews rights of citizenship. If you were born here, you already got rights of citizenship at that time. But there will be such a public outcry against that that it gets moved away. And that really kind of brings in this time of this kind of uncertainty within the community. They feel comfortable here. They know they're not, you know, going anywhere. But it's kind of this recognition of that there is hostility, that there are people that don't want to fully embrace them. And that will be a challenge. Some of these philo-Semitic movements will actually be supportive and encouraging of giving Jewish people full emancipation, but it really starts to come to a head in 1835. In 1835, David Solomons from the Ashkenazi community will be elected the sheriff of the city of London. He will not be able to take office because he's not willing to take a Christian oath. And it won't be until then that following year that the city of London will pass a law permitting in fact, people have to take an oath of office, which doesn't include that. And he will be reelected in 1839 and finally be able to take his position as the sheriff. Okay, but that's really going to be just the beginning, because then the question is, well, can you become an MP? Right, and that's really not going to happen until you get to, I believe it's something like 1856 or something like that. 1858, right? So 200 years after, think of that, right? 200 years after the Jews have actually been here until they achieve what we might call full emancipation. Now, that doesn't mean that necessarily, you know, there aren't still negative attitudes towards Jews, right? Some of those will persist, but at least in terms of kind of the legal standing, after 1858, you know, ostensibly Jews have achieved full emancipation. But it takes 200 years for them to do that. But these debates over emancipation, how do you win emancipation, how do you go about doing it, will also be one of the kind of the things that the community is struggling with at that time, right? In ways that are unique to English, different than the fights for emancipation that will maybe be taking place in Germany, where there's like really entrenched medieval kind of anti-Jewish laws and sentiments. Right here, it's more just they're in this vague place, but they're essentially, though, citizens of the country at the same time. Yeah, Stuart.
Just put some of this into perspective. The first Catholic sheriff didn't happen until 1970s.
Yeah.
The first Catholic lord mayor was in the 1980s. And there have been a Jewish lord, several Jewish lord mayors well before.
But Catholics were allowed to become MPs, I believe, already by 1820 or so.
Yeah.
Right?
But in terms of the city, right.
But what's interesting about that, right? So Catholics are, because at least they're Christians, right? So that's already a movement that's happening. But that's where that debate comes in. They say, okay, Catholics have lied. What about Jews? And they say, well, yeah, but not Jews, right? And that's, you know, kind of the challenge. So during that time, right, during those, from 1820 on, it's really going to kind of resurface of saying, well, you know, what's going on? And there will be, you know, different opinions, you know, within Anglo society about that very question. So those are all the kinds of things that are going on. It's a really, I mean, the more I've read about it, the more I'm kind of struck by what an interesting time this is, and kind of all types of, you know, everything's in flux, right? There's amazing changes that are taking place and challenges that are happening. So in order to give context within the Jewish community, particularly within the Sephardic community, I want to talk about who were the leaders in the Sephardic community at that time, particularly within the rabbinic sphere of the community. And so really from 1800 or so until about 1860, there are three important individuals that need to be borne in mind, okay? The first one in terms of leaders is Meldola, Raphael Meldola, right? That's this figure that you see over here in this picture. Let's go and get it back now. Well, that's hopefully warming back up. Hopefully that'll come up. He is from Leghorn or Livorno, okay? And Livorno has a very large Spanish and Portuguese community. It's the second largest Spanish Portuguese community in the world, only second to Amsterdam. London is perhaps the third. And so he's from there. He is a scholar. He's already published.
He's from London.
Livorno. He's from Livorno. Okay. He has already published some important rabbinic works. And he is invited to come to London to become the rabbi. He takes his position in 1805. He's cool. He has a tri-corner hat. And he is the rabbi here until he dies in 1828. Okay? So he is here during several of these important things that we speak about, right? The introduction of these conversion movements, the fallout with the Disraeli family. He's here for that. And there are a variety of things that will happen. We'll talk about some of the responses that he will make to some of these challenges in a bit. So he's here. One of the other important figures, right? So this is Raphael Meldola, right? It's going to be his son, David Meldola. David is also born in Livorno. He's born in 1797, okay? Right, he's born in 1797, right? We'll do a Disraeli here because this will be interesting for later. He's born in 1804, okay? David is born in 1797, and then obviously moves over with his father. After his father passes, he will not be appointed the chacham, or the rabbi of the community, but he is appointed the head of the bet din. Right, he's considered to be the head of the kind of the court, and so in many ways he's kind of considered to be the chief Sephardic rabbi of London after the passing of his father, even though he's never given that exact position. Now there's another figure that's here at the same time as well, right? And his name is also David Aaron de Sola. Okay, David Aaron de Sola is born in Amsterdam in the year 1796. He will move here with his family, and he will marry one of the daughters of Raphael Meldola. Okay, and so he will be a brother-in-law to David Meldola. Okay, and he is also somewhat scholarly in of himself. He probably, in the history of the synagogue, is the most scholarly chazan he ever had, because that becomes his position. He is the chazan of the community, but as we will see, he's not just a person with a beautiful voice. He is a person with great knowledge and great ambition as well. And you can see his photo over here, right? This is him. He's also cool because he has a tricorner hat. And he will be here as well. So essentially, these brother-in-laws will be the leaders of the community. One is the Av Bet Din, one as the Chazan of the Bismarck's, right, of the synagogue, during these particularly contentious years. In terms of their lives, as I mentioned, he'll pass away in 1828, right? David will pass away in 1853, and de Sola will pass away in 1860, okay? Right, so they live essentially the same, you know, during the same time. Okay, and they're living during all of these various controversies that are taking place. And so they will be, shall we say, a bit of the context for our series, right? When we're going to talk about the different things that are happening, they'll be happening within this rabbinic world of Bevis Marks, okay? And we'll see that they will continue to come into play with some of the figures that we are talking about. Now, they have to face these challenges. Right, they have to face these different challenges that are going on, and they will do so in a variety of ways. Right, they're not just sitting back; they are going to respond to them in certain ways. And so, what are the different ways that they respond to these challenges? Well, they do that by making changes. They do that by making changes. Some of the changes they will ultimately make will be some of the changes that the Reform had advocated themselves to be made, that they will ultimately adopt as well, while trying to differentiate between perhaps halachic or legal kind of requirements as opposed to things that simply were novel, right, within the community, hadn't been done before. But we'll look at that. One of the things that happens, and this will happen the first ones will happen under Meldola, right, is that Meldola will have a reintroduction of the school of the community. There's a feeling that the school is not educating the children sufficiently, that the children are essentially not knowledgeable enough about Judaism and about participation in synagogue life. And so one of the things they will do is reconstitute the community, and they will create the Sha'arei Tikva school, right? Okay, and so that will be brought into place. There had been a school beforehand. They'll kind of reintroduce under this name, Sha'arei Tikva. That's the school today that I'm the principal of, right, or the community's today. A Sunday school, when it was founded, it would have been what we might call a Jewish day school, right? That was the school that you went to, okay? And so they create a new school One of the things they also do is they...
On the side here.
Sorry?
On the side.
It would have been here, exactly. This is where the community was at that time.
Yeah.
Okay. One of the things they will also do in 1824, they will redecorate the synagogue. Okay. There will be a major redecorating effort that will take place in the synagogue. In fact, if you look at the synagogue today, the way it looks is probably not the way it looked exactly when it was constructed, meaning the bones of it are the same, but probably some of the coloration on the ark, on the hechal, the green, and so on, is probably introduced at that time in 1824 when they had renovated the space, right? And part of that is to try to make it more beautiful, right? Keep it up with more kind of contemporary, maybe sense of beauty and so on. And they'll kind of do that by introducing color and maybe adding some more decoration bits around the synagogue as well. And so that will take place. So it'll be kind of a freshening up that they'll do, probably due to saying, you know, we need to kind of infuse a bit more, you know, it's become maybe a little bit tired looking after, you know, after 100 years. They'll do that. And one of the other things they do is they introduce a choir into the synagogue, right? That's not something that would have been here in the 1700s. Now it's something we so strongly identify with the Spanish and Portuguese, but it wasn't part of it historically, right? Choirs were a later thing. And so they will introduce a choir into the synagogue. That's also probably when they will add the choir benches, right? Will be during that renovation that will take place. And one of the other things they do here, and that's actually something that sets apart this community from other Spanish Portuguese communities, is they remove the responses from the service. For those of you that are here on the high holidays, we still do them, right? There's many parts during the service where the chazan kind of says the first half of the phrase and everyone says the second half of the phrase. They would have done that all the time. And in fact, if you go to the Spanish Portuguese in New York today, they still do that. You know, you go to just an RB service during the week, there will be many of these responses. It seems, from what I can gather from different sources, is that they felt that was a bit raucous, you know, it wasn't particularly dignified, people are yelling out, you know, some people are louder than other people, you know, and they felt that it wasn't smooth enough, and so it seems that it's at that point that they say, you know, let's just have the chazan say everything out loud, right, which, trust me, is tiring, and that's something which is unique to London Spanish Portuguese, that literally everything is said out loud by the chazan, but I think that was their way to try and make it more, you know, kind of streamlined. You know, the chazan knows what he's saying, he will just say the whole thing out loud. Of course, ideally, people are saying it quietly to themselves, but there isn't as much of the back and forth that's happening. But all of that is happening at that time in order to make the synagogue experience to be more appealing, okay? And so there'll be those adjustments to the service as well. Okay, those are all things that will happen, presumably under Melitola. Okay, but there will be additional changes that will happen. Perhaps the most significant of them will be the first English language sermon. Sermons were not part of synagogues, you know, prior to these kind of modern times, and certainly in a synagogue like this, anything would have been said in Portuguese, right? Kind of this the native language of the community. And so they will say, you know what, let's have an English language sermon. It's not a sermon that will take place on a weekly basis. It will happen on special occasion. In fact, the person delivering the sermon will submit his sermon to the board of trustees in advance to get approval for his remarks and will then be permitted to do that. They actually ask people to submit sermons for them to review and to kind of select. And the first sermon that is selected to be delivered in English is by the chazan, de Sola, right? He will give the first English language sermon in 1831, okay? That will be the first time the sermon will be delivered in the synagogue in English. He will then go on and spend a lot of his career doing things like translating traditional texts into English. One of the more famous ones, he translates at least parts of the Mishnah, right, the earlier rabbinic codes, into English. And he will also do something else, which is he will begin to codify, right? He begins to codify the minhag. He starts to codify the melodies, and he produces a book which actually records in musical notation the melodies of the congregation. Presumably, you do something like that when you begin to fear that it will get lost, right? That's when those kinds of things are written. So it is represented that there is a, you know, there's an unease about the stability, you know, about, you know, what's happening, assimilation, conversion, reform, and so on. And so he'll actually write down some of the melodies. And so that will be kind of one of the responses to kind of try to anchor the community, is to say, well, let's change it from being a simply oral tradition into a written tradition as well. And one of the more interesting introductions that will happen, also kind of under you know, some of the influence of Meldola and so on, will be the introduction of the first Jewish newspapers as well. And there will be two Jewish newspapers that will launch in 1841, right? And I do not believe it's an accident, right, that happens immediately after the launch of the First Reformed Congregation, because these newspapers are not simply just reporting the news, right? They are editorial papers. One of them will be called The Voice of Jacob. That will be produced predominantly by people from the Spanish and Portuguese community. And there will be another paper that will also launch in 1841 called The Jewish Chronicle. The Voice of Jacob will fold in 1848, okay? And then some people say fold into the Jewish Chronicle. I think that's, you know, maybe not entirely. It's simply, you know, the Jewish Chronicle wins out, right? And it still is functioning. And so that will be something they will do to try and, you know, to try and connect people, to inform them, to influence them, to share with an audience the ideas that the editors want them to know about. And so some of those things will be about education, or about religion, or about emancipation, right? About these different issues, they'll be using it as a mouthpiece to communicate with the Jewish community at that time in a language that they all understand, which is English, right? Because that's now the language of the people. And hopefully through that to try and influence the direction. Okay? These are all things that are going to be happening, in a sense, top down, right? Rabbis, Chazanim, the board, right? All these different groups will be kind of involved in that. But there isn't much happening in terms of what we think of when we kind of think of England at that time, of, you know, pamphleteering and, you know, lots of writing and that type of thing. There is a bit, but there's not an abundance of those things that are happening, right? And that's really where enters our ladies of Bethesmark, right? They will be the ones to create the new content, right, for this new age, right? It's not something that the men will be doing for the most part. It will be the ladies that will be doing that. Before I go on, are there any questions? Yes, Amelia. There are some translations. Yeah, there's some translations, yeah, that will come out as well. Right? So all these trying things to make kind of it more accessible to people. Yeah.
Did the Great Synagogue in Duke's Place introducing this sermon rather at the same time as they were starting?
I don't know the whole history or details about them. There are similar things that will be happening there as well. Right? And some of the responses to some of these challenges, they will start doing them collaboratively. It's not a surprise that the British Board of Deputies, I believe, is founded in 1837. Right, and that's done together, right? So some historians see that as, oh, you see, you know, the Sephardic Ashkenazi divide is, you know, no longer exists, right? Well, it never completely existed even in the first place, right? And in fact, Meldola has a very close relationship with the rabbi at Duke's Place during this time. They do a lot of things together, and they'll collectively excommunicate the reformers, right? There's members in both of their communities that will do that, right? Meaning all of these things, there is. You know, challenge brings people together, okay? Yeah. Yes.
Just so I know that when you speak on many occasions on Friday night, you'd like to point out that this synagogue is the oldest synagogue in continuous use.
Yes.
Another fact for you is that the Jewish Chronicle is the oldest newspaper, Jewish newspaper in the world in continuous use.
Yeah. I mean, that was really the beginning of Jewish newspapers. Talk about that before Nehilah this year, right? That was during the 1840s, you find these starting to pop up all over the place. Okay, so let's talk about the ladies and the pen, okay? Because that is really where they will take charge. Because, of course, they will not be the rabbis, even in the Reform, right? They are not in leadership, they're not on the board, right? So they are not in, actually, any of the positions of authority. In fact, despite that, there is this kind of notion that takes place in English society that sees the public sphere as being particularly secular, and it's the private sphere that is religious, right? Not nothing Jewish, kind of just in the general atmosphere. And that begins to then identify, saying, well, if men are in the public sphere and ladies are the ones who are in the home, then ladies are the ones who are truly religious, right? And this idea of kind of identifying religiosity with ladies is kind of a general mentality that will exist during that time. And there will therefore be somewhat of an effort among the conversionists to say, let us direct our attention to the ladies, right? To the ladies in the Jewish community. They're more religious. And in fact, in Christian society, perhaps ladies have a larger role within the church, right? Or at least kind of, you know, they're not in the gallery in the way that they are in the synagogue, and think that, oh, the ladies are kind of a great way to focus their attention. And it's not surprising, and we'll talk about this more in future lectures, that in many of the novels that will come out in the 19th century by, you know, Gentile authors that depict Jewish people, often depict Jewish ladies, and kind of their conflicts, you know, with religion, and maybe their desire to maybe, you know, leave their old world and find a strapping Gentile Englishman, you know, to join up with, kind of these romance novels as they were, but we'll kind of focus on ladies and kind of see them as the ones who are perhaps are easier targets, right? Seeing women as ladies as more malleable mentally as men. And so there will be kind of that thing that's happening. And so part of it will be a response among ladies to try to respond to the, you know, what they perceive as a focus on them, right? And saying, you know, you think we're this, well, we're not, right? We are devoted to our traditions. We are committed to Jewish society. And in fact, you know, we play important roles within the society while at the same time advocating education for, Jewish education for ladies as well, right? And so they will be promoting that within the Jewish community while also trying to present to the broader non-Jewish world that, you know, that Judaism has a place, you know, in modern society, and Jewish ladies certainly have a place within that. And so that will be something that will kind of be where they will feel almost like it's maybe their, not just responsibility, but kind of like it's their place to respond to, because they're the ones who are being targeted. But what's interesting is that while it seems that with many of these challenges, there are men are taking kind of practical responses to it, ladies, through their writings, are taking some more ideological responses to that, and that they are the ideologues to some degree of Anglo-Jewry. While, you know, they might write things about, you know, the why Jews should be emancipated, you don't find men writing about emancipation. They just say, well, just run for government. And, you know, and that's how we'll kind of push the envelope, is by just kind of like doing it. But in terms of kind of the ideology or kind of the intellectual responses to these things, that's going to come more from ladies. And they see themselves as educators within the community, right? And so they will take an active role and say, we are, you know, we are the mothers, you know, we are the, you know, not even literally, figuratively, you know, and we will make sure that we educate the community, and they take an increasing role within the sphere of education within the community, educating both Jewish people and educating non-Jews as well. And they will do that through a variety of different literary or written mediums. They will do it through writing novels. We'll talk about that next lecture. We'll talk about Grace Aguilar, famous Jewish novelist. They write guidebooks to Judaism and Jewish practice. They will publish some pamphlets. They will write cookbooks, Jewish, first English language Jewish cookbooks, which are also about kind of home life. And they will, you know, through all of those things, try to find a way to respond to these challenges in ways that really other people aren't really doing. And that's incredible, right? That they are kind of the vanguard of those responses to these challenges. And so while these leaders are responding in these ways, right, the ladies are gonna respond to this through the written word. Yeah, question.
I'm just wondering whether in fact this, certainly amongst the Spanish and Portuguese community, that in a way, the way that the ladies' philosophy may have been a legacy from the Muranos, and the fact that in the days of the Inquisition, it was the women far more than the men
who passed down the home.
Going
interesting.
The home.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a really interesting idea. I don't know. I mean, we certainly know that that was the case among many of the Quimiferosos, that it was the mother, the women, the ladies that who perpetuated, you know, at home aspects of the tradition. Whether that was retained, you know, all this time later is an interesting theory. I'll bear that in mind as I do my reading as well. Yeah. So let's take a look, okay? Because tonight I want to now focus on one particular lady who probably makes, in a certain ways, the most intellectual or academic contribution out of all of the ladies that we are going to talk about. And she does something which, you know, is, I would say, entirely unique at that time, in that she creates a Hebrew English vocabulary and dictionary. Okay, that's something that she produces, and we're going to take a look at it together. Okay, we're going to look at some of the things that she does. Okay, so let's take a look. Now, well, let's just talk a little bit about her for a second. The person we're going to be talking about before we kind of look at it, her name is Abigail Lindo. She is born, okay, so let's talk about her. All right, we have Abigail, right? Abigail, you can see what I'm writing. Right, she is born in 1803. Okay, she's born in 1803. She dies young. She dies in 1848. Okay, she dies in 1848. Her mother, her father is obviously Alindo, who is known as being kind of a stalwart member of the community, kind of a very devout man, and a very intelligent person, kind of devoted to ideas of education. Her mother is a Makata, right? There are still Makatas in our synagogue. As I mentioned, there were also Makatas that created the reform as well. So she's part of that family. Her cousin is Sir Moses Montefiore, right, who's also related to the Makata family as well. They're all kind of connected to each other. This one is particularly interesting. Her uncle, his name is Ephraim Lindo. This Ephraim Lindo is the brother-in-law of Disraeli's mother, okay, whose name is Maria Basavi. And in fact, her uncle, Ephraim Lindo, circumcises Benjamin Disraeli, okay? So you kind of see all these connections, and if you think about it, right? I mean, Abigail lives 1803 to 1848. You have Disraeli, who's born in 1804. The two leaders of the community during this time are 1797 and 1796, right? They are all contemporaries, right? They perhaps, as, you know, children, all know each other. Right, running around in the courtyard outside of Bevis Marks, maybe scratching their name into the brickwork out there that you can still see today, right? And so these are the people, right? These are the people that we're talking about. Like, this is their world. I mean, just imagine it, you know? They grow up and, you know, one of them becomes prime minister. You know, one of them is the chazan. One of them is the rabbi. One of them becomes, you know, this lexicographer, you know, for, you know, like they're all doing really interesting, important things. All at the same time. So she produces two works. The first one she had created for personal use, apparently, and then she's encouraged by, you know, friends and so on to actually go ahead and publish it. The first thing that she publishes, this is published in 1837, and then again in 1846, is a Hebrew and English, an English and Hebrew dictionary with roots and abbreviations. This is from the title page, by Abigail, third daughter of David Abarbanel Lindo Esquire. Okay? In fact, on the cover page, she dedicates it to her father, who you can see there, right? Which is found in the book. And I'll just read you a little bit of what she writes over here in the introduction. She says, "The authoress begs to state that she's fully aware her work will not be found free from error, but claims for herself the indulgence of her readers and desires that may be borne in mind that she does not publish it with a view either to fame or gain, her object being to assist those who wish to study the sacred language, and that if that aim be attained, she will be amply repaid for the time and labor devoted to its compilation." Okay? And so she is doing this. She's not an expert linguist, right? She doesn't consider herself to be considered among the great linguists. This is something that she's produced through her own study of, you know, kind of common words that, you know, come up in the Bible or perhaps in the prayer book. And she has written this maybe essentially for herself, but then it will be for others. And it will ultimately then be introduced into the school as well, the school that we spoke about before, Shari Tifal. This will become kind of the study guide, one of the texts that will be used over there as well. In it, she writes, "The author is fully sensible this volume may be greatly enlarged and improved, and hopes that some Hebrew scholar will undertake the task. In conclusion, the authoress acknowledges with gratitude the valuable assistance she has received from her revered father, to whom she feels it is due to make this acknowledgement of his kindness. At the same time, she begs to express to the Reverend David Meldola, chief rabbi of the Spanish and Portuguese Jews, her thanks for the information he has kindly afforded her." And so there's a degree of collaboration in her efforts, but she's the one who actually does this, right? You know, the rabbi doesn't put this together. It's not her fault. She does this. You know, she's the one who puts this together and gets this published. Okay? That's one of the important works that she creates. The other one that she creates comes out 2 years later, 1848, and then is republished again in the 1870s, which is in Hebrew and English vocabulary. Took me a little while to figure out exactly what the difference was. The first book is really what we think of as kind of just a dictionary, right? It has, you know, a list of Hebrew words in there and their translation in alphabetical order, and then has a list of English words with their translation back into Hebrew, as well as a couple other things. This is what she essentially does, is she takes a selection of the daily prayers and writes them kind of word by word with the translation next to them and what the root word of the Hebrew is, okay? And it's essentially meant to be, and she describes it in her introduction, as a way to teach the children what the prayers mean, okay? So let's take a look. She goes, "The following vocabulary was originally written in detached portions for the use of a charitable institution, presumably the school, right? The obvious difficulties of the Hebrew language combined with many obstacles that impede its attainment by the lower classes first suggested the idea of a literal translation from a selection of the daily prayers as a facilitating and speedy medium of enabling the children to understand and join in the devotion of the synagogue," right? The sense that they don't understand. They're not participating in synagogue life. We need to address this problem. There is a practical tool that can be used to ensure that the children understand what's happening. And she writes kind of here at the end, she says, "It is hoped that this plan will be found on trial sufficiently clear to enable the pupil with some slight assistance from a master to make a tolerably correct translation from the prayer book in a short period. And which being all that is contemplated under the circumstances, the compiler will feel amply compensated for the time bestowed should such a result happily ensue." Okay, and so she's doing this for, you know, the betterment of her community, right? And so she is a, you know, what we would say, you know, a highly educated lady, you know, relatively speaking, but is deeply traditional. She's using her efforts towards ensuring the continuity of Bevis Marks, right, into her community. And that's really, I think, special. As I mentioned, and so that's her. Those are her you know, contributions, and that's, in a way, I think, kind of the most academic of all of the contributions we're going to be looking at, less literary, but more actually kind of educational in that regard that she does, right? Very technical type of book, and as I mentioned, it will be reproduced in, you know, many decades later, maybe expanded on, you know, and be continued to be used within the community. It's about the Mariases in Philadelphia. Obviously, it's going to the Spanish and Portuguese community there as well. And so her text is kind of a significant text within the community. As I mentioned, she dies young. She dies in 1848. And there's a beautiful epitaph that's written by David Meldola about what maybe was his childhood friend. And he writes about her, and he worked with her, right? He helped her publish some of these things, and he writes to her the following. I went today to the British Library and dug this up, which was really fun, okay? And you can see it talks about her the same way that she had spoken about herself, right? Memory of the much lamented Abigail, third daughter of Lindo, right? Authoress of the Hebrew and English Lexicon, right? By the Reverend Meldola, right? And it quotes here from her Matseva, right, from her tombstone, which she was born in the, what's called the Novo Cemetery, the New Cemetery, by Queen Mary in Mailand. And it says, Isha Yirat Amonai, right, a woman who fears God, Habetula, she was single, she never married, Avigail Bat Mimi Husei Hakala Kadosh, right, she's the daughter of one of the kind of the ones with great lineage within our congregation, right? Ha-gibir, ha-yashish, ha-nichbad, right? Many kind of terms that we use for only the more respected members of the community, right? The gentlemen, the elderly, the respected, David Abar Benel Lindo, right? But we are yagon va-anacha, right? We are pained, you know, at her passing. And then David Meldola, okay? And here he writes a poem for her. Here you can see the Hebrew, and I'll just read it in the English for everyone's sake. It says, though earth's dark bosom over thy body frame has closed and hidden thee from worldly gaze, thy spirit mingles with the effulgent flame. Thank you. O him, the king of life, mid endless praise, that day of joy thou longest to behold, when the garden of sublimest flowers, thou gathered the good thy works foretold. To reap the harvest of thy mortal powers, let memory still retain them while they stay. A token of thy righteousness above, which goes before thee to adorn thy way and close thee still in everlasting love. The obituary in the month of. So a lovely kind of epitaph that he writes for her. And so she was, you know, a figure that was, you know, deeply respected, you know, within the community. She wasn't just, you know, someone doing something that people kind of maybe looked askance at, or, you know, kind of like, who is she, you know, to do this, you know, and this is hundreds of years ago, you know, and that these are, you know, and she's given her, you know, high place, you know, within the community. And deeply respected for that. And I think that really sets the tone for the ladies we're going to look at, is that they're not doing these things, you know, as rogues. They're doing them, in a sense, with the blessing of the community. They're seen heroically, right? They're looked up to, they're respected. And I think in that way, they act as, I'm sure, role models for others, you know, within the community as well. And I think that really captures, you know, that what we're talking about over here isn't just, you know, kind of, you know, people doing things that are kind of contrary to the community, but they are seen as this is like a positive emergence that's happening in the community. And that's where I really see it as a movement. And that kind of collectively, these ladies are the wise son of the community. They are doing things that are important and impactful, and show a real commitment to maintaining the community amongst all of the challenges that the community is facing. And then in many ways, they are taking proactive measures, maybe with the blessing of those around them, but they are being proactive in creating these responses. And so to kind of put into context, what we're gonna be looking at is many of the things, the different contributions and ladies we're gonna look at, they're all, in a sense, responding to these challenges. They are not doing it kind of just randomly. You know, randomly, I'm just gonna write stuff, right? They're doing it in the context of what's happening. They're also doing it in the context of their community, right? These people who are kind of want to ensure the vitality of their Jewish community. And so in some ways they are reformers, right? They're doing something that maybe hasn't been done, but for the purpose of maintaining the traditional community at the same time. And so they're really, I think, in that way, trailblazers at a time before we think of ladies doing these types of activities. And therefore, I think they are incredibly significant and important for us to be studying about. So we will be looking at these figures over the course of the year. Next month, we will look at probably the most famous, depending on how you look at it, certainly literarily the most famous of all of them, Grace Aguilar. She is widely read in the Jewish community and in the non-Jewish community in England and in America and elsewhere. She's really considered to be like a gifted authoress, a novelist, and so we'll have a chance to learn about her and how she kind of, what she's doing with her works and what her works actually are, and about who she is and so on, but also part of the community as well. So we've gone a little bit longer tonight than usual. Yes. I don't know, but the families are probably connected, I would imagine so. Yeah, these families are all connected. So, okay, thank you all for coming tonight.
Thank you.
And hope to see you in a few weeks. And yes, there are